He buried his face in the crook of my neck, inhaling deeply. I do enjoy your scent, though, and I like you. Very much. I want to protect you. If anything happened to you, I don't know what I would do. I lifted my head to eye him warily. You're not going to do something weird with my dryer lint, are you? I never know what is going to come out of your mouth, he said, staring at me. I enjoy that, in a morbid way. I am saying that even before I turned you, your scent was part of what kept me close to you. What did I smell like? Mine, he said, kissing the hollow of my throat, the tip of my nose, and finally my mouth. You smelled like you were mine. Can you take me home now? Are you tired? He asked. Sophie's methods can take a lot out of you. No, I don't want more people to see me making out with some random guy in the Cracker Barrel parking lot. I'm hardly random, he said, sliding into the driver's seat. I'm your sire. Well, people don't know that because they don't know I'm a vampire, I said, rubbing my wrists. I've already got jobless and publicly drunk going. I don't need to add parking lot hoe to the list. One day you will explain to me what that means, and I don't think it will make me happy, he muttered, turning the ignition. Just when I thought our date couldn't possibly get worse, we arrived at my house to find my daddy waiting on my porch swing with a meat lover's pizza. I hadn't had fatherly approval for a gentleman caller since I was a senior in college. This was not going to go well. Gabriel nodded to the porch. Do you know this man? That's my dad, I said. I still haven't told him. I know, he said. I can leave now. No, the two most influential men in my life are going to have to meet sometime. Hi, baby, Daddy said, kissing my cheek between bites of pizza. Your mama had a sales party thing tonight, makeup or lotion or home decor or some such thing. I never can keep them straight. I don't object until they try to talk her into hosting the things herself. I thought I'd surprise you, but it seems you had plans for the evening. That was sweet. Gabriel Nightingale, this is my father, John Jameson, I said, waving him and Gabriel in through the front door and leading them to the kitchen. Daddy, Gabriel is my... sire? Interfering pseudo-mentor? Guy most likely to be my first ugly undead breakup? I settled for friend.
Pizza? Daddy asked, opening the box to display his cholesterol-laden treat on my counter.
Oh, no thanks, I couldn't, I said. Daddy arched a brow as I pulled out a counter-height bar stool for him. I never turn down pizza. Ever. You're not going on some crazy diet, are you? For a brief, wonderful instant, Gabriel looked stricken. I laughed. No, we already ate, smart aleck.
If you'll excuse me for a moment, Gabriel said, disappearing out the kitchen door.
Gabriel Nightingale. That name sounds familiar, Daddy mused, chewing on a pepperoni. I could tell from the look on his face that he was searching his massive but not quite reliable memory banks for information. He has a lot of family around here, I said, not bothering to add that most of them were in the cemetery. They've been in the hollow a really, really long time. Daddy returned to chewing. Leaning against the counter, I asked, So, what's new with you?
Same old, same old. He grinned, snagging a second piece. Summer classes. Started writing another textbook I won't finish. Your mama's already getting ready for next year's historical tour. I'm not putting River Oaks back on the tour, I said. Aunt Jetty wouldn't have wanted that.
Mama's not going to ask, he said. To be honest, she wouldn't know how. Your mother is at a loss for how to handle this job thing, Pumpkin. She's upset and scared for you, but she's embarrassed, too. She worried about you being single and living on your own, but she's never had to worry about you on the job front. She never thought you'd be in this position. She wants to help, but you're refusing to let her just swoop in and take care of everything. She feels as if she's lost her bargaining power with you.
I snorted. Subtly put, Daddy. Try using fewer pauses. They imply you're searching for the word that will hurt me less than the one she actually used.
Your mother is a complicated woman, he said simply.
And by complicated, do you mean manipulative and emotionally crippling? I asked.
Air quote fingers aren't attractive on anyone, honey, he said, using his authoritative teacher voice. She may be a little high-strung, but she's still your mama.
Daddy wrapped his arm around me. My head fell to his shoulder in that hollow made just for me.
You know she loves you,
he said quietly. I sighed. Yes, I feel the crushing weight of her love from here. He cleared his throat, which I could tell meant he was trying not to laugh.
She doesn't know how to handle a situation unless she's in charge. Just don't expect me to pick a side between the two of you.
Even though you know I'm right?
Janie,
there was the authoritative voice again. I looked up at him making the doe eyes. It was worth a shot. So we talked. Eager for normalcy, I savored the mundane details of the life that I'd been missing. None of the freshmen in Daddy's summer class could write a complete sentence, which was nothing new. My second cousin Teenie's facelift had gone wrong, which just went to prove that plastic surgery is one area where you shouldn't bargain shop. My future Grandpa Bob, Grandma Ruthie's fiancé, was in the hospital having his hip worked on, which meant it was time for his monthly week-long hospital stay. Why was this sweet man engaged to my grandma? I could only imagine that after surviving gallbladder removal, knee replacement, dialysis, and chemo, Bob actually wanted to die, and he saw marriage to her as a legal form of assisted suicide. While Daddy described Grandma Ruthie's legendary surgical ward histrionics, Gabriel returned to my kitchen door lugging a ratty cardboard box. I sincerely hoped vampires didn't substitute pig pieces for flowers and chocolates, but I couldn't smell anything bloody, just the musty scent of old cigarettes and B.O. With his amazing vampire speed, Gabriel managed to shove the box into a nearby coat closet without Daddy's realizing it existed. Daddy went into suspicious father mode, managing to question Gabriel without making it look as if he was interrogating him. And Gabriel, far more accustomed to lying than I, performed beautifully. He deflected all possible vampire giveaways without an iota of irony. He complimented my father on raising such a fascinating daughter. He even praised Daddy's textbook.
I see now where Jane gets her inquisitive nature, Gabriel said.
I suppose I should have thanked him for saying inquisitive and not nosy and spastic. Stuffed to the gills with imitation Italian-style meat products, Daddy rolled out the door sometime later. I only had to drop 7, wow, it's really late hints. I think the phone call from my mom was the only thing that could have pried him away from cross-examining my new friend. Daddy hadn't had the opportunity in a long, long, long time.
I think Daddy likes you, I squealed to Gabriel in mock giddiness. I only hope you ask for my hand before my skanky younger sister runs off with a scoundrel and ruins my reputation and hopes for happiness.
Gabriel grimaced.
That's not funny.
Pride and Prejudice references are always hilarious. What's with the box full of funk? I nodded toward the closet. Gabriel retrieved the box and opened it with a flourish.
A heretofore unknown and disturbing factoid. When you best a vampire in battle, no matter how sad and circumstantial the evidence of that battle may be, you take all of his stuff, no matter how icky that stuff may be. I was the unhappy recipient of the personal effects of Walter the Whitesnake Fan. A silver plate lighter engraved with Screw Communism, several concert t-shirts with discolored armpits, 42 copies of Knight Rider Season 2, and the complete works of Def Leppard on cassette tape.
Walter's mother was eager to have her basement back, Gabriel explained. She was glad to be rid of this. She brought it down to the council office this morning. No one else will want it, so Ophelia wanted you to have it. I believe it's a reminder to stay on your best behavior.
I tossed the cassette single of Pour Some Sugar on Me back in the box. If you beat somebody up, you take their stuff?
Wait, what's to keep someone from challenging another vampire to a duel just because they like their car?
Nothing, he admitted. As long as the vampire can find some reason for the duel, even if it's a contrived reason, some petty perceived slight, the restrictions loosen a bit as you get older. The goal is to keep newly risen vampires from developing a taste for random killing, which is the only reason the council is taking such an interest in Walter's death. They're trying to make an example of you.
I must have made my that sucks face because Gabriel assured me. There's always been a pecking order, a demand for reason, even more so now that we're trying to appear civilized for the humans. This is a stupid system.
Yes, so much less civilized than your corporate takeovers and mega chains, he said, hefting the box. Where would you like this?
Not in my house, I said. Take it to the mudroom and I'll burn it later. Once again displaying that amazing vampire dexterity, Gabriel shifted the box to one arm and reached for the nearest doorknob. It would have been impressive had he not opened the door to the wrong room. "No, don't go in there!" I cried as Gabriel stepped into my library.
"You have a lot of unicorns," he said, his voice shadowed in both awe and horror.
One of the few things I'd done to make the house my own was installing my collection of unicorn figurines on the library shelves. My late grandma Pat, who had been the oatmeal cookies and ivory soap type, bought me a unicorn music box when I was 6. I played that thing until the little motor wouldn't tinkle, "You light up my life" anymore. So, unicorn figurines, music boxes, and stuffed animals became the gift for unimaginative relatives to get me for birthdays, Christmases, Valentine's Days, graduations, Arbor Days. In fact, I just received 2 ceramic unicorn bookends the previous Christmas from my uncle. For reasons even I couldn't explain, I could not throw the little suckers away. The majestic sweep of their horns, their imperious painted eyes, held some sort of strange, unholy thrall over me. So I stashed them in the library, where nobody goes but me. Except, of course, for the one person I really didn't want to see them.
"A lot of unicorns," Gabriel repeated.
I tried to close the door, but he stuck his foot in the jam, most likely to get a better look at my 10-inch ceramic unicorn lamp with the revolving color fiber optic tail. "Fine, fine, you know my secret. I have a unicorn collection."
"That's a very sad secret,"
he said as he allowed me to shove his foot from the door. Strong words coming from someone who was devoured by a sea lion. I snatched the box out of his hands and tossed it into the laundry utility room. Then I locked both doors with a decisive snick.
"I like your father," Gabriel said. "I actually enjoyed speaking to him very much. In my courting days, meeting a woman's father could be an unpleasant experience. There was male posturing, vague threats to my manhood. Sometimes a shotgun would be cleaned in front of me.
You didn't by chance meet these girls' fathers in a hayloft while wearing no pants, did you?" I asked.
"I believe it's in my best interest not to answer that."
I snickered. "My dad's not much of a gun guy, so I think you're safe. Besides, with today's fathers, it's more of a background check and pray for the best sort of thing."
"Duly noted," he said, smiling and leaning against the wall across from me. "However, I am glad to have established a friendly relationship with your father since I have plans for his daughter. Those plans include kissing you again," he said, crossing his arms. The statement seemed as much a challenge as information. "I enjoy kissing you."
"Immediately or eventually?" I asked. "And thank you."
"I haven't decided."
I was proud that I managed not to giggle. "Well, I appreciate the warning." The rest of that, no doubt, brilliant response was muffled as Gabriel decided to pursue the more immediate option. Again, I say, "Woo and who." Gabriel pressed me against the wall, grinning as he nipped my bottom lip with his fangs. He traced the lines of my throat with his canines, pressing ever so slightly against my collarbone with his tongue. His fingers slid slowly up my rib cage, stroking the sides of my bra. He drew circles over my shirt, touching every part of my breast except the nipple, teasing me. Since we're being cheeky, I slid my hand down to a zipper and squeezed lightly. I grinned when he jumped.
"Aren't you full of surprises?"
he chuckled, toying with a strand of my hair.
"Inexperienced, but willing to learn," I said,
and was disappointed when his face didn't change expression. "No response?"
"Besides yay?"
he asked. I smacked his shoulder. I was laughing when he kissed me again, lips molding to the curve of my smile. Gabriel's hand at the small of my back led me down the hall toward the stairs. "Were we going upstairs?" I wondered. As he cupped my jaw in his hands, I found my feet willingly backing up the first step toward my bedroom. He pulled away and ran a hand down my cheek.
"It's been a long night. Time for you to be in bed."
I waited for the little voice in my head to start making excuses, such as, I couldn't have sex with Gabriel, I barely knew him. My room was a wreck. I was caught up in a murder investigation. I hadn't shaved my legs. And I found I didn't care about any of it. I tilted my head and asked, "Will I be going there alone?"
"Tonight," he said. "You're not ready."
I've seen inside your head, Jane, in the jumble of lovely and complicated and, dare I hope, creative thoughts. You're afraid we'll have bad sex and then you'll never see me again. And if you think that way, even with my considerable skill... He paused for me to finish laughing. It will be bad. Look, Dave Chandler left me on the 9th floor of our university's research library without my panties after we lost our virginity together. He never called me again and actually turned on his heel and walked in the opposite direction whenever he saw me on campus. Unless you think you're going to do that, I don't think we're going to have a problem. Gabriel's face went blank. I waved my hand in front of his vacant, staring eyes. Gabriel? He shook himself back into the present. Sorry. Something strange happened inside my head when you said the word panties. The overwhelming urge to kill Dave Chandler combined with a simultaneous loss of blood to the brain. I laughed. And yes, I lost my virginity in a library. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Dave and I were both student library workers, and we did have a generous 45-minute dinner break. It turned out that while the Russian folklore section offered plenty of privacy, seriously, no one ever went up there, the shelves left really weird bruises on your back. Lesson learned. Gabriel slid into his jacket and pulled me close. When you're ready, I will be the first to run for the bedroom, stripping out of my clothes and singing hallelujah at the top of my lungs. That's an interesting blend of imagery. Gabriel played with the hem of my blouse, tickling the skin just above the rise of my slacks. Besides, when I take you to bed, we're going to stay there for a long, long time. I don't want the sun to interrupt us, which it would in just a few hours. Did he say hours? Gabriel kissed my slack mouth and asked, No response? Yay? Chapter 11. While most vampires develop special abilities, some do not. If you run into vampires who do not have gifts, it is not wise to mock them. They still have vampire strength. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. The Hollow's vampire grapevine works even faster than the human gossip lines. After word of my super-secret council tribunal got out, my nights were suddenly filled with calls and visits from my new underworld buddies. Dick called, but he just left dirty voicemail messages. Let's just say, if I'm ever in the market for a massage involving canola oil and marabou feathers, I'm covered. Missy called, but her message was more of the low-down dirty girl variety instead of plain old dirty.
Jane, honey, I'm sorry if I'm breaking up, but I'm in my car, and you know how the bottoms are. It's the land that cell phone towers forgot.
Her tinkling laugh rattled my ear through the receiver. Even from across the living room and muffled through the phone, Fitz's head cocked up at the shrill sound. You're where? The bottoms were low-lying areas of McClure County near the river, mostly swampland and marshy pastures, hardly the kind of property that would interest the Hollow's top vampire real estate agent.
The bottoms, honey, the bottoms! There's a little farm down here I'm trying to get my hands on. Just between you and me, the owners don't know how much the property's going to be worth in a few years. So it's up to me to talk them into retiring and letting me take the property off their hands so they can move in with their kids in Florida.
That struck me as sort of evil, but in the great spectrum of possible vampire evil doing, probably not that bad.
The reason I called, honey, other than to check on one of the Hollow's latest undead additions, is to invite you over to my place for my famous Mojito Mixer Monday.
When my confused silence buzzed over the line, Missy informed me that she hosted this bastion of undead yuppiedom twice a month, featuring imitation Cuban cocktails and real vampire professionals. It was a chance for the local undead to make connections, meet potential pets, and become more established in the Hollow's nightlife. Missy had a rotating guest list that included a mix of newbies and long-established vampires. I could only guess that her Rolodex was a dark, scary place.
Everybody's going to love you! We've never had a librarian in the mix before. It will be so interesting!
And Dick Cheney's going to be there.
He's a close, personal friend. He mentioned that he met you the other night. He says you have a great personality.
Isn't that like saying I'm stump ugly in man language?
Come on, Shug. We have to get you out there. You've got to network,
she wheedled in her syrupy voice. Considering that my social interactions with other vampires so far had amounted to a beating and a cranial root canal, I did my best to decline politely.
I really appreciate the invitation, but cocktail parties aren't my thing, Missy. Also, I don't have a job at the moment, so networking with me would probably be a waste of time.
Are you enjoying the gift basket? Missy asked sweetly.
Loved it. I've been meaning to write a thank you note, I said, gritting my teeth at the rather obvious social strong-arming tactic.
Missy was not so subtly reminding me that she'd done something nice for me, and here I was being rude when all she was asking me to do was attend a nice party. This was the way Southern women worked, all peaches and cream laced with arsenic.
Oh, honey, don't worry about it. I know you haven't had time, she said. The first few weeks are so hectic. Working out your feeding schedule, sleeping arrangements. I'm surprised you're as together as you are.
Grrr.
Are you sure you couldn't make it on Monday? Missy asked. It's just a little party. I just want to see you make some new friends, that's all.
I'll think about it, I promised.
I'll send you an invite. You'll love it, Shug. Bye!
She giggled before hanging up. I looked down at Fitz, who was lying on his back, flipping his ears back and forth over his eyes. Not for the first time, I envied the simplicity of his life. How exactly did she get my email address? I asked. Andrea broke our contact embargo and called. Her counsel questioning was far friendlier than my own, by the way. Ophelia even paid for Andrea's pancakes. When someone is a link in your food chain, you tend to be more polite to them. Sensing my boredom and distress, Andrea offered to brave the wrath of the council and bring over some dessert blood and her favorite girly movie. But I had only sat through the divine secrets of the Ya-Ya sisterhood once in my pre-vampire days. I considered it a sort of afterlife resolution never to suffer through that again. We settled for ice cream, for her, and Queen of the Damned, for me. We'd gotten as far as the concert scene when one of Andrea's clients texted her. He'd been attacked by several quarrelsome business associates outside a Dairy Queen and needed an emergency transfusion. As she slid into her strappy black sandals and downed some iron supplements, Andrea admitted a stunted social life was an occupational hazard for blood surrogates. And my excuse was what, exactly? I made good use of my free time. I made a strong effort to read every page of the Guide for the Newly Undead, twice. I made arrangements with a company that sold and delivered synthetic blood in bulk so I wouldn't have to run out to Walmart every week. I experimented with various fake blood concoctions that would add some variety to my diet. There were a few bright spots, but it was generally a progression of entertaining and spectacular failures. Let's just say that tomato juice, Tabasco, and blood should not be mixed. Blech. I even looked up meditation exercises to try to find ways to focus my energy and harness my chi and all that stuff. All right, so I probably didn't take it as seriously as I should have. But I found out I can stand on my head for extended periods of time. I spent a lot of time with Aunt Jetty, or dodging Aunt Jetty. Now that I was aware of her presence, she felt free to move objects at will and follow me anywhere in the house. Undead senses or not, I still got startled when someone suddenly appeared behind me in the shower. We had a long chat about boundaries and the ready availability of exorcism rites on the internet. On a more menacing note, it was very subtle, but a few times I thought I felt someone watching the house. If I stayed still enough, I could sense someone standing at the edge of the woods, and the presence was downright jarring. But by the time I got to the backyard, whoever it was had vanished. One night I was reading, and I thought I saw a dark shape move outside my parlor window. I immediately reverted to frightened single woman instincts and ran for my phone. I had dialed 911 when I realized, hey, I have superpowers, and ran out the back door. The scent was faint, bitter, and somehow vegetable, like bad asparagus. This is going to sound crazy, but it smelled like greed. I filed that away under weird new Jane thoughts while I searched the garden for the covetous intruder. I followed the scent to the edge of the trees that lined my yard. Whoever was there was long gone. I had to start running faster. This was embarrassing. I spent the rest of the night on the porch with an antique hunting rifle from Grandpa Early's collection, just hoping that whoever it was would show up again. Did I know how to shoot? No, but there was always the chance I could club the intruder with the rifle or maybe throw a bullet at him. Besides, it was much safer than letting Fitz run loose to patrol for trespassers. I couldn't risk my mysterious visitor hurting him. Also, the last time I did that, I lost Fitz for about 2 weeks. Zeb finally came by for a visit while I was installing my spanking new security lights. He watched in awe as I deftly balanced on one foot on a wobbly ladder, handing me the wrong tools and cracking jokes about the probability of me electrocuting myself again. His guess, 97%. He wanted to leave some room for the possibility of me falling off the ladder while electrocuting myself. But he was very evasive and made vague excuses for not seeing me over the last few weeks. He didn't tell me about the new girl he was dating, and considering how long it had been since Zeb's last date, this was worth a mention, or possibly a billboard. I had to extract the information from his brain. A startling development in my fabulous vampire powers was being able to put together mental pictures while Zeb was talking to me. The signal was patchy at best, like trying to watch scrambled pay-per-view. There was a tingly buzzing right behind my ear. Then an image would spring into my mind. Zeb told me he spent Friday night reading the Bible to his grandma. I saw him at an Italian restaurant with an unbelievably pretty girl with sleek auburn hair and almond-shaped green eyes. She was laughing, actually laughing at what Zeb was saying, and I could detect no drunkenness or mental defect on her part, so I could only assume she knew she was dating him. In my vision, he reached for her hand and knocked over a water glass. Then the picture faded out. "So," I sat on top of the ladder, crossed my arms, and gave him a smirk. "How is your grandma?"
"Fine," Zeb sighed. "Driving my grandpa slowly insane gives her a reason to live. My mom, on the other hand, is focusing on driving me insane, which is not as fun."
"Still wants to know when we're getting married, huh?" I asked. Zeb made a miserable face. Ginger Lavelle had never quite shaken those images of Zeb and me playing house when we were little. Okay, me forcing Zeb to play house when we were little. She convinced herself long ago that no matter how much we protested or dated other people, we would eventually see things her way and give her the daughter-in-law and grandbabies she'd always wanted.
"Actually, she's decided she's mad at you for not following her professional advice."
"She gave me poofy bangs. I looked like a TV evangelist," I cried, hopping down from my perch and giving the newly installed lights a testing flick. Zeb winced at the sudden flood of light.
"Well, since you so coldly and callously tossed her aside as your personal cosmetologist, she has decided that you are not worthy of the Lavelle name, and I should instead marry Hannah Jo Butler. Hannah Jo gladly lets Mama give her perms that make her look like an electrocuted poodle."
"Well, thank God you have someone to make these decisions for you," I deadpanned as I sat down on a porch step.
"I begged God for a brother, a sister with a lazy eye, anything to distract her. But no, I had to be the only child to the heat-seeking missile of motherhood. Hannah Jo keeps showing up at my house with pies, saying my mother sent her over. She's been at Sunday dinner every weekend for the last 2 months. Mama's making a Christmas stocking with her name on it."
"What happened to my stocking?" I demanded.
"She ripped your name tag off and is hot-gluing Hannah Jo's on in its place," Zeb admitted.
"Well, good luck to the both of you," I grumbled.
"I'm sorry I didn't call you over the last couple of days. I lost my cell phone."
I arched an eyebrow. "And you haven't been able to find your landline either?"
Nope. He laughed nervously. "I guess that means it's time for spring cleaning."
"It's September, Zeb." Zeb looked down and to the left, a sure sign of lying, and another image came up. Zeb was walking this girl to the door of a neatly kept trailer. He obviously wanted to kiss her and leaned about 20 degrees in, but hesitated and pulled back. So the girl grabbed him and pressed him into a full-on lip lock. I couldn't help but feel a twinge of jealousy. I do not have warm, squishy feelings for Zeb. but I'm so used to being the only woman under 50 in his life. Also, here were two young, vital people starting what could be a bright future together. They could get married, have children, grow old together. I couldn't do any of those things. I was wallowing in the depths of self-pity and general melancholy when the picture changed again. In the midst of his fictitious description of a Sunday spent hanging out with his parents, I saw Zeb trying to round to second base.
"Ew!"
I yelled, vainly attempting to wipe the image through my forehead.
"It's not that bad," he insisted. "Better since my dad stopped drinking homemade persimmon wine."
"No, you big liar! Ew! To the image of your over-the-sweater action!" I cried. "You were out with a girl this weekend. I saw the whole thing in my head."
"You read my mind?" he exclaimed. "That's just... well, it's extremely cool. But I don't think I'm comfortable with you knowing what's going on inside my head."
"No one's comfortable with knowing what's going on inside your head," I snorted. "I didn't mean to invade your mental privacy. Really, I'm sorry. But why'd you lie to me, Zeb? I'm glad you're going out with someone. Seriously. Is she nice? What's her name? Where's she from? What's she like? Are you going to answer my questions, or do I have to whack you with a stick until delicious candy surprises fall out?" Zeb sighed, rubbing his temples.
"I don't want this to be weird.
I can't make any guarantees, but let's give it a shot."
"Janie, I've been going to meetings, and they've been really helpful."
"All right, then." That was out of left field. Beyond the occasional overindulgence in wine coolers, Zeb had never had what I would see as a drinking problem. And after seeing what running a backyard meth lab did to his cousins, he never touched drugs.
"Do you mean like therapy?" "It's more of a support group for people who are dealing with alternative lifestyles."
"Oh." I thought for about a second before it struck me.
"Oh.
How could I have been so blind? I'd been friends with Zeb for 20 years. Why hadn't I noticed the lifelong lack of a serious girlfriend? His conflicted feelings about his father? His strange obsession with Russell Crowe? He was the only person in the state of Kentucky who actually saw a good year. I threw my arms around Zeb and hugged him tight. It was the first time I'd touched him since turning that he hadn't stiffened his spine and gotten all awkward.
"Oh, Zeb, why didn't you tell me?"
Weird pause amid the hugging.
"I just did."
"You could have told me years ago. I would have accepted you no matter what. It wouldn't have changed anything. I love you."
Weirder pause. "Accepted what?"
"You being, you know," I said, trying to find the most sensitive way to handle this life change without hanging umpteen million crosses around my neck and stabbing him. I tried to learn from our mistakes.
"But what about the redhead?
Wait, is she a he? Because if so, she's pretty convincing." Zeb made a sound somewhere along the lines of, "Rawr!" Then,
"What?
No." Well, now I was confused. "You mean you're not gay?"
"No. Why would you think that?" he cried.
"You said alternative lifestyles."
"No, your alternative lifestyle, you tool," he grunted, waving in the general direction of my head, which I guess meant my fangs, or maybe my brain. Sometimes it interfered with the way I was supposed to live my life.
"Jane, I've joined a group called Friends and Family of the Undead. It's a support group for people whose loved ones have been turned into vampires. We meet every week and talk about how to deal with our feelings about your new lives. You know, being unsure of our safety around you, making you feel welcome in our lives and our homes, stuff like that."
I stared at him. "Why didn't you just tell me that?"
"I didn't want you to feel like I was so upset about your change I had to seek psychological help, even though, well, I did," he said. "But it's been great. There aren't a lot of people who understand what going through this is like. It helps to talk about it. I think you should come with me sometime. It might help you talk to your parents."
I don't know if I'm ready for something that public.
"It's anonymous," he insisted. "It's a lot like AA without the drinking. One of the rules is that you can't talk about what's said at the meetings or who's there."
This is the Hollow, Zeb. 12 steps of confidentiality mean nothing. Remember that time Flossie Beecher started a Sex Addicts Anonymous group and ended up having to change her phone number?
No one will know you're there because you're a vampire, he said. You could just be there because someone you know has been turned into a vampire.
If I come to one of these meetings, can I meet the mysterious redhead? I asked.
As a matter of fact, that's where I met the mysterious redhead, he said, grinning. She belongs to the group. Her name's Jolene.
There was a tone in his voice I hadn't heard before. Fondness. Pride. Zeb was talking like a man in love. This did not bode well. Women do not usually respond favorably to their boyfriends having female best friends. Pretty soon, Zeb would break our movie nights to hang out with Jolene and their other couple friends. Our code of inside jokes would be broken by a woman who insisted on knowing what the hell we were talking about. I would slowly be phased out until I was that girl Zeb used to hang out with before he grew up. I smiled brightly. Well, now I guess I have to go. Chapter 12. Trying to blend groups of friends from the living and undead worlds can be difficult. It's better if social events involving both the living and the non-living do not center around food. Some more comfortable themes include poker games, bowling nights, and historical reenactments. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. From the outside, Greenfield Studios looked like a respectable family photography business in one of the newer buildings of the Hollows Riverfront Business District. I didn't know anyone who'd had their pictures done there, but the company had only set up shop a few months before, and it was difficult to get Hollow residents out of the Sears Christmas card photos habit. I'd parked Big Bertha almost two blocks away and around a corner, trying to give myself some pep talk and walk time. If I'd needed to breathe, I probably would have been hyperventilating with my head against the steering wheel. I hadn't been on a job interview since just after college. And if the head of the library board hadn't been one of my favorite high school English teachers, Mrs. Stubblefield probably would have launched me out of the room with some sort of spring-loaded chair. I reread the want ad. Greenfield was advertising for an appointment secretary with a pleasant phone voice, good communication skills, and a people-pleasing personality. Having two out of three wasn't bad. One out of three wasn't bad. This was the first ad I'd come across that actually sounded somewhat appealing. I could handle an office job. I could handle pleasing people, to a certain extent, as long as it didn't inconvenience me too much. It seemed sort of odd for a photography studio to be open all night, but the supervisor, Sandy, who was supposed to interview me, said clients made their photo appointments after they got home from work. I climbed out of Big Bertha and straightened what I hoped was an appropriately secretarial outfit, a red cardigan and a black pencil skirt that Andrea had helped me pick out. I had also accepted her ridiculously high black heels with the ankle straps because she said they made me look sophisticated yet sensible. On the walk to the office, I felt well-dressed yet nauseated. I rang the bell outside the brick front entrance and nervously fingered the manila envelope that contained my resume. Sandy turned out to be a tiny, bird-like woman in her 60s. She reeked of Virginia Slims and had a voice like scraping the bottom of a whiskey barrel, but she looked like the poster woman for clean senior living, with fluffed curls of pure white and a face that was carefully made up. She was wearing a rose-colored tracksuit, a white golf visor, and a rhinestone pin shaped like a kitten at her shoulder.
"Come in, come in,"
she said, smiling as she led me to an all-beige reception area. The lobby was clean, newly painted and quiet as a church.
"It's so nice to meet you."
Sandy gestured for me to sit, and I handed her my resume. She crossed her leg primly as she sat in the overstuffed armchair to my left. She looked over my qualifications while I filled out the surprisingly scant job application. Greenfield Studios didn't seem to want to know much more about me beyond my name and social security number. However, one of the boxes asked for my life status, and I was supposed to check whether I was living or undead. While it was illegal to ask an applicant about race, age, or marital status, it was still perfectly legal to ask whether he or she was a vampire. Congressional lobbyists fighting against undead rights claimed it was a public safety issue, saying that employers had the right to protect their workplaces from dangerous predators. I left the space blank and hoped Sandy wouldn't notice until after I'd gauged the office's general attitude toward vampires. I handed her the application, and she smiled brightly.
Well, it seems that you are more than qualified. You have a solid employment history, which is always nice to see in someone your age. Could you do me a favor, honey, and read this out loud for me?
Sandy handed me a badly copied sheet of paper with several paragraphs in all caps. Hello. My name is Blank, and I'm calling this evening on behalf of Greenfield Studios. Our records show that you have indicated an interest in having your family portrait taken with Greenfield. I'm calling to help you schedule an appointment and to tell you about an exciting new product.
That's very nice, she said, pulling the script from my hand. So, when would you like to start?
This seemed rather quick. Why wasn't she asking me more questions? Why wasn't she asking me to tell her about myself? Why was my potential supervisor wearing a tracksuit? And why exactly did the script appear to have me calling people at home to schedule appointments instead of the other way around? And what was the exciting new product? The ad said you were looking for a receptionist.
An appointment secretary, she said, nodding. You would call people who have willingly and legally given us their contact information and book appointments for them to have their family portraits taken.
Why were the words willingly and legally necessary? Wait a minute. Pleasant phone voice, good communication skills, and people-pleasing personality? This was not secretarial work. This was telemarketing. I don't think this is going to work out for me, I said, hesitantly rising to my feet.
Oh, honey, please, just give it a try, she cried. You've got the voice, and you're well-educated, articulate. People who are lonely, just waiting by the phone hoping someone will call, they'll love talking to someone like you. You could make a lot of money doing this.
Okay, we were talking about telemarketing, not phone sex, right? But I've never done telemarketing before, I said, clutching my purse like a lifeline and taking a step toward the door.
Oh, we don't like to use that word around here. We prefer telecommunications-based sales.
And the difference is? Sandy ignored my question.
You said you needed a night job, and you won't find many nice, safe sales jobs with hours available this late. We call the West Coast until 8 p.m. Pacific time. You get on-the-job training, and you won't find a sweeter group of girls to work with. We're just a big, happy family here.
I chewed my lip and cast a longing glance at the reception desk, which I now noticed was brand new and looked as if it had never been touched. I could not afford to be proud or picky. I had bills to pay and a dog who expected to be fed occasionally. Besides, they probably weren't going to ask me to do anything grosser than scraping chewing gum off the bottom of tables or degunking a grease trap, both of which I'd done regularly while working at the dairy freeze in my teens. Hell, I was the one who ran for the vomit dust whenever a kid got sick at the library. Nothing could be worse than that. Right now, something was better than nothing, and this was something. When can I start? As I rounded the corner, I couldn't help but think I just made a rather large mistake. I was not a salesperson. I was definitely not a telecommunications-based salesperson. But I'd already given Sandy my social security number, and I think that's the point of no return in terms of employment etiquette. Sandy had even given me an information packet on Greenfield Studios and how the company was bringing affordable family memories to you. I was supposed to review the materials before Friday, my first night on the job. As I turned toward the block where Big Bertha was parked, the breeze carried the scent of blood. I looked around for an injured person, some source of the smell, but the scent was old, the blood long cold and dead. The closer I walked to the car, the stronger the smell. I could make out splashes of red across the hood. I jogged closer to see that some ambitious soul had scrawled, "Blood-sucking whore," in huge, dripping, bloody letters across Big Bertha's paint. What the hell? I gaped. What? I slid my fingers through the crook of the U. The blood smeared sticky and cold across my fingers. It was animal blood. Something gamey. Deer blood. Cringing, I swiped my fingers across my skirt, too shocked to worry about the stains it would leave. I scanned the street for any sign of the vandal.
There might as well have been tumbleweeds blowing across the asphalt. Shock gave way to fear, fear to anger, then anger to shame. And when I realized I was actually tearing up because someone wrote mean things about me on my car, I rolled right back to anger again. This was a nasty girl trick. This was high school stuff. My hands were shaking so badly, it took several passes to try to pull my keys from my pocket. And now I was driving around town in a car declaring that I was a blood-sucking whore. No one would notice that. I slumped low behind the wheel and drove on as many side streets as I could. Fortunately, there were very few people who needed to wash slanderous graffiti off their cars after 10 p.m., so I had the auto spa all to myself. As the remnants swirled red around the drain of the car wash bay, I pondered the list of people who might have victimized Big Bertha. Unless Sandy had some sort of senior citizen ninja skills, I doubted she'd be able to beat me back to my car, bloody it, and then get out of sight before I got there. Could it have been a friend of Walter's? A human who guessed my secret and was determined to out me whether I liked it or not? The more I thought about it, the more pissed off I got. I was a grown woman, a vampire. People weren't supposed to be able to pull crap like this on me. By the time I turned the newly bathed Bertha onto my driveway, I'd gripped the steering wheel so tightly, I'd warped it. Big Bertha now aimed slightly to the right, no matter how I steered. That was kind of an improvement. I couldn't burn Walter's festering grab bag of personal effects. It seemed mean and petty, especially when you considered his fiery end. I decided to give the box to Dick. He was the only person I knew who had some sort of history with Walter, and the only person I could think of who could unload so many Knight Rider DVDs. I made absolutely no effort to look nice. Plain white shirt, fat jeans, no makeup. I was planning to go to one of Zeb's photo meetings afterward, so I wanted to stand out as little as possible anyway. I knocked tentatively on the door, half hoping he wouldn't be home. I wasn't in the mood for dirty charades. The door swung open, and out stepped a familiar, barely dressed blonde. "Missy! Wow, you're mostly naked," I exclaimed.
"Hi, Shug," she said cheerfully.
You'd think that someone with a public sales persona like Missy would be embarrassed to be caught in a position like this. But she soldiered through the situation as if she weren't just wearing an old Lynyrd Skynyrd t-shirt and a smile. "Hi. So, I guess the other night on the phone when you mentioned you knew Dick, you meant that you knew Dick. Wow. Awkward."
"Jane?"
Dick came up behind Missy, barefoot and buttoning ragged Levi's. He looked mildly embarrassed, but not embarrassed enough to go put on a shirt. I just stared, unsure of what to say or where to look. "Hi," I said, settling for a long glance at the pull-tab wind chime dangling from Dick's porch light. I intentionally hoisted a mental brick wall between my brain senses and whatever was going on in Dick's and Missy's heads. I did not need those visuals haunting me for the rest of my immortal life.
"What brings you over, Jane?"
Missy cooed, smooching Dick's neck.
"Do I have competition from my sweet Dickie?"
"No," I said, too emphatically. Dick was too occupied by Missy's full-on oral assault to look offended. I tried to hand the box over, but Missy wound herself around Dick like a strangling vine. A strangling vine with a butt you could bounce a quarter off. "I just wanted to drop this off for you. It's Walter's stuff."
"Oh, honey, I heard about that awful mess,"
Missy said, pulling herself away from nipping Dick's Adam's apple.
"You just let me know if there's anything I can do for you."
Pulling her tongue out of Dick's ear would have been a nice start.
"Don't you have a meeting to go to, baby?"
he asked, untangling himself.
"Why, yes. The Undead Realtors Association is meeting tonight. I'm the chapter president,"
Missy told me. She laughed, tweaking Dick's nipple.
"Wait, are you trying to get rid of me so you can get to your next appointment?" "You'd better watch yourself, Jane. We may have a little catfight over my dickie."
Missy laughed and disappeared into the trailer. Dick caught my apparently horrified expression and said,
"She's just messing with you. We're not dating or anything. It's not even what you would call a relationship. We're just..."
He looked away, avoiding eye contact.
"You know, sometimes you just need a lukewarm body."
And there's the Dick I know and
barely tolerate, I said as Missy opened the door. She was wearing another slick pink dress suit and fluffing her blonde curls back into their junior league gone slightly slutty style.
Well, I'm off, Shug, she said, then leaned in for another tongue bath.
She winked at me.
Jane, don't forget, Monday, mojitos at my place. You promised you'd try. Y'all be good now.
Did I use the word promise? I should be going too, I said, as Missy slid into her sporty little car. I hope you find some use for that stuff. He smiled, opening the door to show me his rumpled, fold-out couch.
You know, you could stick around.
Again, I'm going to have to ask you not to finish that sentence.
What's the matter, Stretch? We could have a lot of fun, you and me.
Dick leaned in far too close and made preliminary moves to kiss me. I leaned out of it until I was bent back at a spine-breaking angle. Spicy man-treat though he may be, Dick was not boyfriend material. He was just barely respectable acquaintance material.
Dick, I said, I'm really flattered, but I'm not going to let you use me to piss off Gabriel. But I do want you. I want to hear you whisper, pant, and scream my name. I want to know what kind of panties an out-of-work librarian wears, he said, grinning lazily. Pissing off Gabriel would be an added side bonus.
I laughed, hoping it would cover up the involuntary shivers Dick was giving me. I hadn't lived a sheltered life where attractive men didn't say that sort of thing to me, but I hadn't had sex in 3 years. Do the math. You two have no idea how alike you are. Dick, I like you, but don't make me choose between being friends with you and doing whatever the hell I'm doing with Gabriel. My choice wouldn't make you happy. Instead of taking my rejection at face value, Dick smirked.
You like me?
You're mildly amusing and remotely charming when you're not giving me the full-on Pat O'Brien routine, I sighed, rolling my eyes. Plus, you're one of the few people who actually tell me what they're thinking, even when I don't want to know. I appreciate that.
And you want to be friends?
He asked, scratching his head.
I don't know if I've ever been friends with someone with breasts, particularly breasts like yours. Can I still make inappropriate remarks about you and your person?
Suddenly self-conscious, I crossed my arms across my chest. I don't think I could stop you if I tried. The friends and family of the undead met at the Traveler's Bowl, a restaurant featuring healthy cuisine. It was known locally as that place where they sell hippie food. Zeb said the FOTU meetings were the only thing keeping the restaurant going, besides the glass sculptures they sold at the gift shop. I hadn't spent a lot of time in head shops, but I recognized a bong when I saw one. I bought a large mineral water and some hummus, even though I wouldn't be able to eat it. Most chickpea consumption is based on misplaced politeness. But I wanted to do my part for the proprietors, a nice-looking artsy couple who had sunk their life savings into overestimating Half Moon Hollow's palate. It was hard to get local residents to eat anything involving wheatgrass, sprouts, or lentils. If you mashed all those things together into balls and deep-fried them, you might have something going. The FOTU, which, given the surroundings I kept calling tofu, consisted of 20 or so people of all races, ages, and socioeconomic classes. They were individuals who never would have spoken in real life, but seemed to share a strong bond within the walls of the Traveler's Bowl. There was Carol, a cook at the coffee spot whose brother Junior had been turned by an angry ex-girlfriend. The family had no idea what had happened until Junior flipped out in the middle of a Sunday dinner and tried to bite their uncle. Daisy's banker husband turned in the midst of a midlife crisis. Instead of buying a sports car and nailing his receptionist to avoid thinking about death, Daisy's husband chose to stop the aging process altogether. Daisy was pretty angry at first, but now she was confused about whether she should let him turn her too. She felt pressured to make a decision soon, as she aged a little every day, but he was forever 47. George's daughter was turned on a bad date, and now she refused to speak to anyone in the family. He couldn't understand why she just cut off contact with them. He and his wife were left mourning someone they still occasionally saw at Walmart. Each of them hurt. Each of them offered understanding and sympathy to the other members. Each tried to keep a sense of humor. Carol pointed out that had she been thinking clearly, she would have aimed her brother's fangs at her Aunt Cecile, whom no one liked. Every meeting started with the pledge.
a collection of 5 truths the group promised to remember. I will remember that a newly turned vampire is the same person with new needs. I will remember that a loved one's being turned into a vampire does not reflect on me. I will remember to offer my vampire loved ones acceptance and love while maintaining healthy boundaries. I will remember that vampirism is not contagious unless blood is exchanged. I will remember that I am not alone. Seeing my vampirism from my parents, or even from Zeb's perspective, was sobering. A loved one had died, but there was no funeral, no chance to grieve, no chance to adjust to their complete change in lifestyle. Plus, there was the embarrassment of telling friends and family that your son, sister, friend had become infected with vampirism, and worrying that the new vampire would go all evil and hurt you, as in the case of Carol's brother. It all convinced me that I was not ready to come out to my parents yet, if for nothing else than to spare them those feelings as long as possible. Fine, it was a rationalization, but that didn't make it any less binding. I didn't know if anyone in the group could tell I was a vampire. No one asked, which I found refreshing. I was the only one in the room that night, but Zeb said they had a few local vamps who attended off and on. Based on the group's commitment to confidentiality, he refused to tell me who they were. After discussing changes in vampire legislation, the members traded stories and tips. For instance, I learned about a company in Colorado that made SPF 500 window tinting for cars, allowing vampires to drive in full sunlight. Carol announced that she'd come up with several recipes to help make vampires feel more welcome at family meals. Even as a vampire, I had to say that plasma pop jello molds sounded gross. Eventually, the group broke up to socialize, which was obviously their favorite part of the meeting. With Zeb distracted by a funny story from Carol involving her brother, a silver platter, and a confused pawnbroker, Zeb's new girlfriend bounded up to me and almost knocked me flat. Jolene was just as I had pictured her in my visions, gorgeous in an exotic way that added up to one strike against me liking her. A perfectly oval face with high cheekbones and a lush pink mouth that tilted at the corners. Extremely long, even white teeth that glinted in the low light of the restaurant. Wild curls that shifted from auburn to fiery red to strawberry blonde, depending on how she tilted her magnificent head. Long-lidded emerald eyes fringed with sable lashes. There was something not quite right, a fierceness to the features that unsettled as much as it staggered. I imagined that males of any species would be willing to overlook that. I consoled myself with the fact that the nasal backwoods twang that fell from those bee-stung lips strangled dead any sort of Tomb Raider fantasy Zeb might harbor. The twang was the second thing I noticed, after the weird body odor. It wasn't an unpleasant smell, just an organic punch to the system, like fresh-cut grass and apple skins. Maybe beautiful people smell different from most? "It's so nice to meet you," she squealed. She swiped at my shirt, which was now covered in crumbs from the bran muffin she'd been eating. "Zeb's told me all about you. We're so glad you could join us." "Well, Zeb said the group has been really helpful and everyone seems so nice," I said. "He said you'd been coming here for a while?" She shrugged those smooth, tan shoulders. "Well, my best friend since high school was turned a few years back. It took her a year to come out to me. I felt like an idiot for not seeing the signs. It was hard. My family, well, they just don't trust vampires. Never have. And it took me a while to adjust to her being undead. I'm having to overcome a lot of built-in prejudice." "Good for you, though, for trying," I said. "So, do you and your friends still hang out?" Jolene's lip trembled. Her eyes flashed, an electric glow under the green. I looked around to see if anyone else had noticed, but they were too involved in their kale rolls. "No, Tessie." That was her name, Tessie. She got dusted about 6 months ago. Her family said it was an accident, but she was always so careful. She wouldn't have gone out so early, with the sun still up. I miss her. I'm sorry, I said, squeezing her arm. She tilted her head and smiled. "Well, the group's been really sweet with me. I'm sort of dealing with a whole nother round of grief. My family doesn't really understand what I'm going through." "I'm glad," I said, meaning it. I hated to think of how Zeb would feel if I'd died and he had no one to turn to for support.
Good.
She nuzzled and kissed my cheek and bounded away to snatch some of Daisy's pita crisps. Seriously, the woman never stopped eating. She'd gone through an entire 1-pound bag of peanut butter M&Ms during the meeting and was now trying to sweet-talk a kale roll out of George. The burly trucker was happy to hand over the high-fiber treat. Zeb wrapped an arm around me.
What do you think?
She's gorgeous, I assured him. Charming, very affectionate. But, did she just quit smoking or something?
No. Why? He asked.
Well, she hasn't stopped eating the whole time we've been here, and she's not exactly a stocky gal.
Okay, you have to promise that you're not going to freak out,
Zeb said, pulling me away from the rest of the group. You pretty much guaranteed that I'm going to now, but go ahead.
The thing is that... Well, Jolene's a werewolf,
Zeb said, his voice lowered.
Oh, ha ha, Zeb. Halloween's not for a few more weeks,
I laughed, mugging spookily.
Ooh, Jolene's a werewolf. You brought me to a vampire support group meeting to introduce me to a werewolf. I guess that explains the long teeth and the flashing green eyes and the nuzzling.
Oh, crap, you're serious, aren't you?
Yep, Zeb nodded. Her whole family's made up of hereditary werewolves. It's not a curse or anything. She was born like this. I was sort of surprised you didn't guess, to be honest. I thought you creatures of the night could sense each other or something.
How would I possibly guess werewolf? Swimsuit model, maybe. But it makes sense. If vampires are real, then I guess werewolves, the mummy, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and the rest of the Universal horror movie standards must be real, too.
Wait. Does that mean she already knows I'm a vampire?
I whispered. Jolene came up behind me, tapping my back and making me jump.
Zeb told me on our first date.
It took me a few seconds to register the different emotions I was experiencing. Hurt, a little betrayal, the sting of being excited.